$2,000 in the bank. I've got a lot of cushions, so I have no problem.
You know, you gotta think about regularizing your status vis-a-vis the draft, etc.
Yeah.
Okay?
People live too regularly.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. I would underline the kinds of things I just underline this other point about working as hard as you see fit on trying to sort out for yourself what has happened and communicating it to people like them and the chancellor and so forth, but on the other hand, not trying to serve as an informal PIO person for the university and try to reach reporters and so forth. Let them do it as best they know how, and let Jack handle it in whatever ways he's got available.
I just don't think you can make policy. I think that my inclination has always been to hang back, and it still is, but you can't make policy decisions on that and see how it plays out. PIO blows it,
I encourage you any and every time, should you feel it useful, come and talk to me about
okay,
it.
Okay,
try to make myself available in these next weeks. I will be available. I'm not going to be traveling. I'll be here. Call up, come over.
Great. Thank you.
We'll talk, and I'll mostly be found either here in physics.
You're a beautiful, calming influence, and so is your wife. I appreciate that. I just have to get this down before 3, okay. So I'll
bye.
Thank you.
We had lunch at noon with Dean Alpert and with David Pines. That lunch was to be an information center for information briefing for Dean Alpert, but this is incidentally Saturday now, must be about the 14th of September. It was to be an information meeting for Dean Alpert, but actually we covered a lot of things. Dean Alpert is giving lectures, and in this case he gave a magnificent lecture upon the functioning of a university bureaucracy. We discussed, he wanted to know, his question was, just exactly who is in charge of this program, how are the administrative lines drawn? And I began to sketch that to him, and telling him about the informal, quote, committee for 500 that met last spring, that actually most of those meetings were devoted to talking about money, where it would come from, that the chancellor's decision seemed to be that each college and each department would have to figure out its own program, and the admissions and records, for example, and financial aids would each handle their aspect of these things. In other words, that no special bureaucracy was being set up for these kids, just as no special program was being prepared for them. The chancellor has decided to go the route of the Berkeley Special Educational Opportunity Program, which treats these students like ordinary students except for an occasional special course, and not the route of the Southern Illinois program, which pretty much has set up a separate curriculum for them. Dean Alpert shook his head, made the analogy with the centennial year and how we, of course, did not set up we do not want to give the impression to visiting Professor X when he arrives that somehow or other a whole special bureaucracy has been set up to handle him. We want him to get the idea that every time someone comes in his status, we handle him well. And we did do that, and certainly if he were to arrive and find absolutely no rooms in the union and nobody doing anything about it, and if he were to feel that, in fact, we had not exhausted all possibilities, we might expect him to throw a large tantrum. This was his remark at the beginning, and I think it's obvious how he has seen this whole flap on the part of the students. I responded that what I had been trying to tell Dean Alpert for some years was now becoming obvious. I hoped he realized that that this was the point, that in fact our bureaucracy treats all students miserably, that they get that these kids got the usual shitty treatment, and that they responded about the way a dignitary would. And I think considering that they were recruited and the circumstances under which they were recruited, this probably is a fair assessment. We also discussed that whole business of how they were recruited, and Dean Alpert contrasted our process of sending out black students without any secondary interviews, apparently by university officials. We reviewed, apparently, documents, but we did not talk to people. He contrasted that with what they do at Trinity, where he says the director of admissions is of the caliber of a small college president, a fantastically competent, able, sensitive guy. The point was made that the point was made that Peltison has kept all the old dopes, has moved them up one rung on the ladder, that it is not obvious that we have the very best people throughout our administration, and certainly not obvious that they handled this at all well, or could have even been expected to do so in light of who they are. This was a very important point about I guess, bureaucracies, and particularly this one. Dan also made the point that in logistics, in particular, there must be that top 5% of non-bureaucrats, the people who simply transcend the bureaucratic mind and do uncalled for, unheard of things. And his example was Helen Hay going down and simply telling admissions and records that the graduate students whose forms are currently being held up for various reasons will not be charged late admissions fees. You know, he says this simply transcends the bureaucratic mentality. It would never occur to a bureaucrat to suspend that. His example may not have been the best, but we all got the idea. He later on pointed out that what we don't have here, basically, is someone assisting Shelley, who is a David Eisenman, who knows, in other words, the ins and outs of the bureaucracy and knows how to get around them to some extent. It is true that not only are the kids new here, but so is Shelley, and that when it came time for help to be called for, Shelley was in no position to call because he didn't know anybody. This seems to be true in light of the evidence that everyone was on vacation as usual in August, which was precisely when they were needed. Now, we then proceeded from these preliminary discussions of the background of the situation, the summer and the preparation for the program and so on. We proceeded from that to a discussion of what exactly happened the other evening, and Dan added several things to this picture which I've been putting together, which are very important. Also present at this meeting with Dan Alpert and David Pines was a gentleman we will refer to as Harvey. Harvey entered the union at 9 p.m. For a cup of coffee, came upstairs after his cup of coffee and ran into a large number of black students in the South Lounge of the Illini Union, and he described what he saw as a sort of a festive air. He expected that if he were to look back in there, he would see somebody playing a guitar. He said some were dressed in very colorful clothes. It looked as if it was a dance or something of this order of magnitude. He thought to himself it must be part of the week's program and apparently proceeded on out of the union. The same person returned at 11 p.m. having found out that this was indeed a protest demonstration of some sort, and he discovered that the mood by that time was very different. He chatted with Joe Williams at about this time, and between 11 and 11:15, the word was given to him in the presence of some black students that it may be dangerous for white people around there soon, and that this is Harvey, ought to consider leaving. Harvey speculated that this might have been a self-fulfilling prophecy, that once it was suggested that, in fact, it might be dangerous for white people, perhaps it became dangerous for white people. But anyway, we now have an eyewitness who reports that at least at 9, still, the crowd was festive, which is what Bruce has claimed all along, Bruce Morrison, and that perhaps at that time it would have listened to a calming influence. Just as I came into the center, at this moment, it's now 3:10 in the afternoon. I just walked one half of a block with a black boy I met not too many days ago and have never introduced myself to, and I simply said, "How does it look to you?" Well, obviously, this is a very forward start, and who the hell am I, and so on. But he finally commented just after a couple of sort of fruitless exchanges. He asked me where I thought the real problem was, where the worst threat at the moment was, and I said, from the legislature, and he said, "Yeah, man," and then he says, "That chancellor's boxed in the middle," and he says, "If the guy had only come out at 9 o'clock," he says, "you know, the kids were looking for somebody who they felt wanted the program and knew something about it and also was in a position to do something, and if he had simply talked to them at that time," he says, "it would never have happened," and he just shook his head, and he says he didn't know it was going to happen, and he kind of walked off. Okay. There are some things we need very definitely to fill in the picture. I do not know these things at the moment. I do not know the movements of Clarence Shelley during the evening. I don't know where he was and when he was there and who he was talking to, and I also don't know what role he was playing. Was he trying to answer questions? Was he looking for people who could answer questions? Was he simply acting as a moderating influence? What was he doing? It would be useful to know. It would also be useful to know the exact police movements. We do not have that. It is crucial for us to find out if anyone from the administration showed up at the union prior to 11:30. When anyone from the administration any time during the evening talked to the students, it is very important to know what they did or said and how many heard them. And it's also important to know, of those who heard them, how many heard what they actually said, what messages actually were heard. I think that reasonably covers the more details about what might have happened. And the assistance of Harvey filled in some of these important details. Now, I think the only further thing I have to say is that there was some discussion of my status at the University of Illinois and in this whole matter. It was clear that I have made myself a self-appointed reporter on this subject. However, Dean Alpert made it very clear that his position would be very hard line on people who are guilty of doing damage and attacking individuals, that he would throw the book at them. He also said, however, that he was going to not stand for any concealment of mitigating circumstances, and he now has a pretty good idea of what was happening, and he would like as much documentation as I have and anyone else has, and he will insist on getting it from the security office, and he is a member of those disciplinary hearings. He is not going to, he swears, knuckle under to any pressure to throw the book at people who ought not have the book thrown at them. And the difficulty now that arises for me is that this is so close to my own position. His emphasis, for example, upon the details, his emphasis upon the necessity of indeed prosecuting those who are guilty, and I'm spending some time locating who they are. I think that our positions are so similar that it is untenable for me to be an employee of his, because no one in a million years would believe that I simply set out to do this and was not somehow or other put up to it by him, or that there isn't some more direct connection between us than there is. Consequently, for the good of everyone, it is going to be important for me to get out of my position as assistant to the Dean of the Graduate College and the Center for Advanced Study. And so as of the moment, I have several options. It was Dean Alpert's suggestion that I could be really most valuable working for Dean Shelley, basically steering problems through. I do not think that that is feasible, given Dean Millett's feelings about the type of operation that is actually required here, in both Dean Alpert's and my opinions, and about me in particular in running such an operation. And my further discouraged because I doubt that there are any funds for such a thing. And I also wonder if I were once in that position, if indeed I would be as free to do what needs to be done on a number of other fronts, such as public opinion in the state and so on, as perhaps I can do. So I'm initially negative, but I will go in to talk to Clarence Shelley. There are other possibilities. I could become a research assistant for someone like Mike Atkin in the Ed School. Then my research could perhaps consist of continuing to do what I'm doing, basically, to follow educational policy in this instance through to see how the different influences and the different circumstances cause the thing to be played out the way it's going to be played out. There's Heinz's long-standing invitation to do something over his way. I think I can probably get a secretary in an office over there right away, and maybe something else later. I think it is ironic that I am basically having to leave my position with the university in order to save the university, but I've long since transcended that kind of bag. It's maybe says something about our bureaucracies that the only way that one can keep them functioning for the good of the people who they serve is to be without them and transcend them. I don't know quite what I feel about this all right now, but I'm just sort of in turmoil. Okay, I think that covers the salient points of a luncheon discussion with Harvey, with David Pines, and with Dean Alpert in Dean Alpert's office between noon and 2 today. A postscript I would like to add to what I've just recorded. Before I went over to see Dean Alpert, I had a long discussion with David Pines, and David had just seen the Chancellor. The Chancellor had the following things to say, that really it would be possible to come up with mitigating evidence for most students, that a number of faculty members who are their advisors are already writing letters saying that they have interviewed their students in detail, believe their stories, and are quite convinced that they were not involved in any kind of destruction or damage to persons. It has also been remarked between by the Chancellor that really if the right wing were writing the Black Students Association things the last 2 days, a better job couldn't have been done. Let me think if there's anything else pertinent that the Chancellor said. I guess basically the only other thing is that the Chancellor is sticking to his story the other day that he hopes that the majority of the kids can get off this thing. He really does believe that there isn't going to be any problem with that, and he also is aware of the fact now that the guilty ones, I don't know any of this. I guess, strike all that last stuff, it probably isn't true. Stick to only the firm things I said before I paused. It is now roughly 3 a.m. Sunday, This must be September 15th, the day that presumably my contract would begin, if in fact I were going to be employed by the University of Illinois. I'm reducing the volume a little bit, see if we can get the tape clearer. I've just gone back and listened to everything that's on this tape from the beginning, and I have a couple additions to make to my activities at lunch with Dean Alpert. Among other things, I described to Dean Alpert, to David Pines, the scene in the union, in the Graduate Student Association office on Tuesday morning. And I haven't described that scene, as far as I know, for this tape, so perhaps it's useful to read it into the record. as I guess I've said, I went to the union with a couple of donuts for Bruce at 2:30, and I came up to the GSA office. Bruce's activity at this point was to ask us if we were ready to start making calls out to bring the white kids in, because he felt that if the blacks were going to be arrested, if there'd be something of that sort going on, there should be a white sympathy demonstration going on at the same time. And apparently he had said such a thing to the chancellor. Let me see now. There was the bust. I was out kind of wandering around, saw it, came back, and Bruce at that point was on the phone actually calling people to get them in there, telling them there was being a bust and the white kids should be involved. I guess it must have been reasonably soon after that that I got the story from him about having called the chancellor and their exchange and how it went. And I think that most of that is in the record. And certainly each of them will be able to give it to me at some other time. Anyway, after that, I guess I just sort of wandered around to see what was going on, and I ended up in the Black Students Association office, where I met a girl who had just come in from Chicago, having flown into there from Philadelphia, and she was apparently told by the housing division secretary over there that she was to find a motel room for the evening and that they would fix her up in the morning, although she swore that she had called up at 11 in the afternoon, or 11 in the morning, saying that she was stuck in Chicago and that she would have a late flight, and did they have a room for her, and they apparently told her to come right ahead. Well, my point is that I did interview the kids in the Black Student Association office, just kind of pieced together the story as much as possible, and I was not taking anything down at this point. Just getting it in the head. And then, about the time I finished with them, which really took a long time, a good hour and a half maybe, other people were gathering in the Graduate Student Association office, and it was Vic Berkey and company. All the people basically who signed the statement. These people were looking for things to do, and there were a number of things discussed. I finally suggested that we had better get the facts out, that whatever they expected people to join them in doing, they said people had to know what it was all about. They agreed to that. They then said, well, how are we going to go about writing this thing? And I said, well, you can get eyewitness reports from the kids. You can find out what it was all about. And I've just been doing that. So all we have to do is get that down on paper and get them to, you know, help us with it. And they said maybe that was a point. So I guess at this point, maybe the kids were in the office at this time. I believe there had been some discussion. I have a scene in my mind where the office is filled with white guys, and the black kids are kind of looking in the door, and I finally said to that group, say, you know, I really honestly think we ought to let those kids in here. For heaven's sakes, it's their thing, basically. And the response to that was, well, actually, it's our thing that we're planning right now, but somebody else immediately chimed in that it was really reasonable for those kids to come in, for heaven's sake. So I brought chairs in, and they stood there rather ill at ease among us as we talked about what we were going to do. We, meaning they, because I didn't participate in that kind of stuff. For one thing, I didn't have any legitimacy at this point. Berkey is suspicious of me enough already without me suggesting what that group should do. But after they floundered around a while, when I suggested the information thing, they pretty much bought that. And then I volunteered to be the scribe who got the story from the kids, and no one opposed that, which I felt was fairly lucky. I was being, I felt, rather bold. I then went with these kids to the VIP office and sat down and then started to type. And it probably isn't the best way to do it, but I was trying to get basically four kids at this point. The number was reduced from about 10. I worked with 10 earlier. I was trying to get four kids to agree that what I was saying was a reasonable representation of what they had told me, but I couldn't very well try to get it verbatim back again, because they were jumping back and forth from one thing to another, and some of them were there at one time and some of them were there at another. And some of them then therefore confused the things they'd seen with the things that we were talking about at any particular time. So I simply sat down at the typewriter and said out loud what I was typing and typed. And any time there was a discussion over what I was typing, we would stop, and we proceeded with painstaking care. It took quite a bit of time to turn out this one or two pages worth of material. When I had a reasonable rough draft that the kids and I could agree on, the kids could agree on, meaning they're agreeing with me that I was getting it right. Anyway, when we got that, I took that back to the GSA office, and I tried to read that to the crowd. Now, Bob Solomon was there by that time, and Bob had a lot of rhetoric changes he wanted to make. Finally, people shouted him down and said, for heaven's sakes, let's pay attention to substance. By this time, Michael Rossman had shown up with Patsy Parker, and the two of them were also actively participating in this thing. Now, when it came time to report what Millett had said to the crowd and to report what the Chancellor had said to Morrison, there were motions from Solomon to edit these remarks. Other people were agreeing with him. The thing they wanted to edit out with Millett was the sentence that girls would be allowed to go to their dormitories even though it was past closing time. They couldn't see where that was relevant. They said they felt it was an unnecessary detail. I felt that it was something that was a little bit mitigating in Millett's instance, and I held out for that, but I lost. The next thing was over what the Chancellor had said to Morrison. And the Chancellor's conversation with Morrison was rather lengthy, and Bruce had reported most of that to me at about 3, shortly after 3, he told me what the Chancellor had said. But what he was now claiming was upmost in the Chancellor's mind to avoid another Columbia quotes. And that's what they wanted to quote, was that the Chancellor was there to avoid another Columbia. They also have Millett, you see, quoted as saying that it might be better to protect the property, to act immediately to protect the property, than to take a chance on it and have the Chancellor come and speak. So there was an attempt made to show the administration as being callous and feeling more concerned about property and about public opinion than about anything else. And I violently opposed these things really just about as violently as I could. And it took every ounce of energy I had, and I just had to play a real, real hard game, because so far I had been allowed to get away with authoring this thing, even though I was a suspect person, and now I was fighting over the rhetoric. And I simply kept appealing to the kids. I said, basically, this is their story that they told me. If you want to bring them in and get them to agree to have certain lines dropped from it, this was an instance with Millett, then I'm agreeable to that, but I certainly don't think we should drop it without consulting them. That was the tack I took. The answer to that was, it isn't their thing, it's our thing. And it was hashed out, and they finally said that it really was irrelevant what Millett said. Well, now, from this perspective, maybe they were right. I was perhaps being a little bit defensive, more defensive than I might have been. On the Chancellor's thing, however, I felt it was extremely important to include the sentence that the Chancellor was concerned about the success of the 500 program, and that had at least been a factor in his decision, and also to include the fact that his decision was made after consulting with his advisors, because I was already suspecting, you know, I mean, I know enough about this place to know that it's perfectly possible that Chancellor Peltison doesn't know half of what's going on around here, and that people cover for themselves when they report what they do know. I did not like the idea of painting him the way that he would have been painted had we said that the substance of his remarks was that he wished to avoid another Columbia. I felt that gave the situation miserable perspective. Okay, enough about that. I want that in the record here, and that was, in fact, something that I said to Dean Alpert and David Pines and our third friend this noon, between noon and 2. I did this to remind them that Bruce has a problem, and I further said, with respect to Bruce, and I felt this applied to David Addison too, that the biggest hang-up is a fear that the university is going to lose its cool and throw the book at kids who basically didn't even understand why they were in the union, what the whole thing was about. We're not involved in any damage or in any assault. I think that both of those people are very aware of the political pressure on the Chancellor and the university to do something of that sort, in fact, and since they know that it may be very difficult to pin down who actually did the damage and who was involved in the assaults, it behooved Dan, anyway, to reassure them that he would not allow any whitewash of the university's case, and that he would not allow any evidence to be introduced into the record that was anything other than gilt edge when it came to prosecuting these kids. I see now, of course, that the whole of my argument is that the interpretation of the evidence, obviously, is something that Dan has no control over. In other words, if the court decides that just simply having been there was an accessory to the damage, which is not an unreasonable position, as was pointed out to me at lunch the other day, then the book still could be thrown, even if Dan does everything he can to keep the evidence straight. Well, anyway, I said to Dan I felt it was necessary to give his resolution to proceed as honestly as possible. He has to convey that to Bruce and to David Addison. That was basically the first thing I said at the beginning of this whole conference. In fact, we made a joke of it because I said to David Pines, you know, I said I would slug him if he told me what to do. I said, now I'm going to start right out by telling him what to do. And Alpert visibly stiffened, incidentally, on this exchange. I meant it to be humorous, and I must say that the whole thing went very well. I was able to shut him off, I think, without angering him a couple times when he got ranting about things that David and I have certainly heard many times before. It was by and large a very quiet, relaxed, calm meeting, and the thing I'm learning is that sometimes when things get very serious, I'm being more reasonable than they were when things were just in my mind that it was serious. It's interesting perception about myself. Sorry to ramble. All right. Now I have to take us through what happened since then. When I stopped recording the tape previously, before I began this session, that was 3 o'clock, and I had to run off to Florida Avenue Residence Hall, where I was to talk to a bunch of kids. Well, I did talk to those kids. They were all white. They did not read Reader's Digest, but their parents did. Their general perception of the word, less interactive session, I thought. I talked too much. There was less interaction with the kids than I would have liked. But we kind of use the current situation to sketch what is wrong with universities, what is wrong with university bureaucracies, what is wrong with the ordinary students of the universities, what is wrong with the faculty. Pointed out to them that how many faculty would be just delighted to study this situation, but how few would get involved in it, how wretched the bureaucracy really is, how we as students don't form any kind of community. And that led into a discussion of communities like Hitler's and communities like ours during the Second World War, where people talk to each other on the buses, things of this sort. And I just knocked on communities for a little while, what they meant, under what conditions we find people uniting with that kind of strong bond, and just reflecting a little bit upon how one might go about thinking about communities and then maybe acting on the need for communities here in America today. So I was sort of tying in urban, racial, university crises together and floating it all on the basis of a liberal arts education as being part of the key to the answer to these things. You had to have some kind of perspective if you ever hope to accomplish anything in these areas. I enjoyed it. It was a nice 2-hour respite from everything else. I came back to the Center for Advanced Study and called in at home and found that we were having a party this evening for Harris Wofford. So I spent the rest of the evening at that. But I've picked up some information along the line. Apparently, shortly after I left the Center for Advanced Study this afternoon at 3, the Chancellor called for me. He did not get me. He got David Pines instead. Now, he was apparently going to ask me if there was anything I could do to speed up the testimony of white students who would actually be able to name black students who had beaten them up. David Pines, of course, did not know where I was or how I could be reached, but he called the Graduate Student Association and he, as he put it, took a chance with giving the message to Bruce. And apparently Bruce put Marty Shupak on the phone with David Pines, and Marty was absolutely screamingly incensed that the university would be out looking for a scapegoat, and that it would be, putting any pressure on him or anyone else to come up with some. But Marty just said to me, man, he said, have you seen Pines? And I said, well, no, not particularly. And he says, well, I really lit into him this afternoon. He says, whatever, put him up to that thing. And he rather implied that I did, so I'm afraid that I may have lost some credibility with Shupak. It will look as if I put the administration up to putting pressure on Shupak, and I'm very unhappy about this development. I think Pines blew it pretty bad. I'm reminded that during our conference this afternoon, Dan Alpert specifically said to him, keep your nose out of this, you don't know anything about it. You know, when David started offering himself as a marvelous person to intercede with David Addison. Well, you know, I mean, Pines is a good man. He's helped me a lot, but I'm just giving this background because these are vignettes. These are the little things that each of us is running a risk of doing at every point. We can always upset somebody else's game, and I have to remember that, and David has to remember it. We all have to remember it. Okay, it did not succeed then, and one of the reasons Shupak got so incensed is apparently there was a meeting in the union this afternoon called by Cornum, student body president, which brought together heads of the Blackstone Rangers, which apparently is the gang in the North End, and the kids who were beaten up, and other members of the community, and John Lee Johnson basically took a hard line with the guys from the North End. This could well be a result of his interaction with Mel Reif last night, and Mel's interaction with Willie Williams today, and which I assume came back around to John. But John was basically saying, man, like what I could figure, is that we've got to kind of think about what we mean, what we really want in this community. Do we want access to the union? Are we going to get it if our guys can keep getting away with beating people up? You know, we just might get cut off. He appealed to their self-interest, he appealed to their sense of fairness to other people, apparently, and they were really calling him Uncle Tom, which is a really remarkable position for John Lee to be in. But apparently the end of the whole thing was that guys came around and they said, all right, we don't hate every black guy. Maybe you are human beings too. Maybe we won't beat up on you. Well, I mean, I don't know what the hell great emotional experience this was this afternoon. This is a rather rough account of it, as much as I can gain, but I should probably go ahead to the evening, except to say that explains why...